Come to order, please.
Oh, for the pool?
Good morning, it's the House Resources Committee, it's Tuesday, February 24th. President, our members, Cotton, Springer, Davis, and Sunday Popper. We're going to try to wrap up testimony today on from the meeting we had last week. We were discussing generally the topic of environmental concerns and considerations as to the development in the coastal plain. That should take less than a half hour, and then we were going to hear from some people that wanted to discuss the general topic of local hire and labor's interest in the development. We'll start with David Roseno. Did I pronounce your name right?
Mm-hmm.
I believe you're with Standard Oil Company.
I'm with LGL Alaska.
I understand you have a presentation that you're prepared to go forward with. Please proceed.
My name is Dave Roseno. I'm from Fairbanks. I'm currently a research biologist with LGL Alaska Research Associates. And Standard Alaska Production Company asked me to provide some comments on variation in calving and use of the calving grounds in terms of ANWR. A little of my background, I'm quite familiar with the porcupine herd. I was involved in the Arctic gas work. I followed the herd extensively each year, conducting studies on it 1972 through 1977. And have continued to keep up on some of the data that's come in on the herd. Primarily, I want to show you some of the variation that occurs in that herd and address the map that occurs in the 1002 report. Basically, a little background, caribou are very gregarious social species and are highly migratory. Life cycle consists of a number of things that happen throughout the year. Spring migration, post-calving movements, and so on. Most people have the impression or the feel for caribou being migratory, and I think a lot of people have the idea that they go north in the spring and south in the fall. Actually, they're migrating basically 12 months out of the year. They're constantly on the move. And this life cycle is basically traditional, as best we can tell, related again to their gregariousness and social behavior. And the calving grounds is part of that tradition. And throughout the various phases of the life cycle, we see a lot of variation, whether it be in spring migration, wintering areas, so on. We also see that same sort of variation in the calving grounds. Basically, what it boils down to is that caribou have, each of the herds has a calving ground. Calving grounds tend to be a general region that the herd does indeed go to traditionally year after year. And if there are any attributes that all calving grounds have, they're basically two. One is that they tend to be areas that are relatively predator-free, and the second item is that they're areas that are quite open and have little concealing cover for predators. And basically, when the caribou go to a calving grounds, they don't necessarily go to the exact same place every year, nor do all animals go to that same place. And here I'm speaking of the cows, of course, that are going there to have their calves. And I can show you a bit of this variation, if I could, with the overhead. Throw this up first. It still doesn't quite cover the entire calving grounds, but the calving grounds of this particular herd, the porcupine herd, is roughly 200 miles in length from Canning River in Alaska to the Babbage River, which is
quite deep into Yukon territory. Tends to average from 30 to about 50 miles deep, depending on where you are in it. And this is the traditional calving grounds that the animals are going to. This just happens to be an overlay that's somewhat different than in the ANWR document, showing areas where concentrated calving in all years 72 through 1985 have occurred, to give you an idea of the size of the area that's used over time for intense calving. These maps, by the way, if you'd like to look at them more, and I'm just going to show a few, are in the document that Standard provided. This is just an example of calving in 1972, the first year we did the work. The herd, the cow segment of the herd, was roughly split 50-50 between Alaska and Canada. We also had a concentration in each of those areas. Following year, we saw a broader distribution, and in fact, no concentrations. Animals were very evenly distributed. And I should add here that a lot of this, what happens here, is dependent on snow cover and spring storm conditions as the animals are arriving on the calving ground and so on. In this particular year, very little snow, animals spread widely throughout the area.
What part of the year was that?
What part of the year? Mm-hmm. This is during calving, roughly starts about the 25th of May through the 15th of June. That's in fact something I wanted to mention. It's generally, it's about a 2 week to 2.5 week period during which the animals are dropping their calves. Again, another year showing a very deep penetration into Alaska. This is basically the farthest west we've had animals go, with a large concentration very far west towards the Canyon River.
Excuse me, were there climatical conditions that would have explained that concentration westward, or what?
Right. It's actually a little more than climate. What it amounts to also is where the animals are wintering each year. Some years we have, for instance, this year, virtually the entire herd is wintering down here near the letters that say Brooks Range in the Arctic Village area. Most of the time they winter fairly deep into Canada, but they're split between these areas. So the proximity to the calving grounds, also climatic conditions. But the conditions involve a number of things, which may include storm fronts that hinder the animals, even though snow cover is relatively good all over. Areas may have deep snow, but if the snow is hard, animals may penetrate a long ways along it. If in other cases they run into deep snow, that would affect them. And in fact, I can mention that here again in the underclass. This is just an example of a year where we had many smaller concentrations scattered throughout the area. And one thing I might as well mention right now, which addresses the map in the 1002 report just a bit, is the fact that calving is a very dynamic thing in that it occurs over roughly a 2 week period. And as animals calve, and especially in years when animals penetrate into Alaska, cows drop their calf, generally pause about 24 hours, and then they're up and moving again. So that it's not a case of animals all going for one very specific area and they continue drifting westward. This was a year, first year, that we had the majority of animals. As far as we know, there were no concentrations. And the majority of the herd calved in the Yukon Territory, much the reverse of that other year. Another quick example, again, the majority of the herd in 1982, and this would address your question. Interestingly enough, conditions were relatively good in Alaska, but when the animals neared the border area, there was a series of storms that came in from the north. And so they basically just paused in this area and calved on the Canadian side. Then they continued to move later on westward. to Alaska. Again, a case similar to that, but with a fair proportion of the herd in Alaska and several large loose concentrations of animals fairly far northward coastally compared with the foothill zone where they often are. In the last example, again, the herd about two-thirds in Alaska, a third in the Yukon, two concentrations, but a very large moose concentration.
Now let's address the last points to the 1002 map in that. Basically, what I'd like to get across to you is that here it is on the wall. It's made up of a series of overlays of these annual concentrations. And I've got a couple of problems with it, given what I know about the herd and its use on the calving grounds. And that is that actually this map tends to lead one to believe it tends to give the flavor of densities or increasing densities as it comes down into the red area here. And actually, that map shows regular use of that area. It actually shows the frequency of occurrence of presence of those concentrations, not densities. The densities varied. And each one of those concentrations of animals from year to year contained very different varying proportions of the cows in the herd.
Chairman, could I?
Go ahead.
Just on that point, just so I understand what it is, you're saying the red down here is just shows higher use than this area here rather than density?
Correct. In fact, they try to indicate that here by saying how many years. In other words, there's areas that were 1 out of 9 years, years that are 9 out of 9 years. But they also here say that the red areas are areas of greatest concentration. Again, that's not necessarily true at all. It's basically a frequency of occurrence situation. And interestingly enough, as time goes on, we have, in terms of frequency of occurrence, an area between the Congacut River and the Firth River straddling the border that now we've had concentrations in that general area for 7 years, including this last year, varying from relatively small proportions of the cows to very large proportions of the cows. And so the whole point here is that I think the tendency is to think of that as one small fixed area that the animals all go to calve, and it's just that's really not the picture. They're, in this particular case, what we can say is because of the tendency for snow to leave these upper foothill zones, it's a fairly regular use area and will probably always be fairly regular use, but it's not necessarily a fixed core area that the animals all go to.
Could you give us a short definition of concentration?
Okay. As used in ANWR?
As you're using it.
Okay, well actually these concentrations are a fairly subjective thing. Over time, no density information was gathered, and basically what it boils down to is when you're flying a survey out there, you run into caribou, you're picking out visually, it's both a function of the size, the number of animals, and how close together they are, and you're picking out the quote concentrations that stand out. If you picture salt and pepper, these tend to be a little denser, but some of them are much denser than others. And in fact, you can have a square mile several miles away. Let's say if you actually measure densities, where there may be 300 caribou in this square mile, you wouldn't consider that a concentration. You see this other scattering of caribou out here that stands out to you. It may have 100 animals per square mile, but visually appears to be a concentration. And that's basically what all of these concentrations have been.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up, the definition of concentration over time from 72 to 85 is fairly subjective. It isn't. Nobody sat down and said a concentration is 300 caribou per square mile or 400.
No,
it's always relative year to year that
right.
This
it's
year
relative.
Is.
And in fact, one of the reasons that these maps have a boundary, actually some of the original maps that I did actually have three things on them. One is a dashed line that shows the general calving grounds, and what that plots are the outlier cows, the very outside cows that have brought calves. And within that area, and these dark lines on these maps, were generally drawn to represent the areas within which the majority of calving occurred. And then within that area, you would have these concentrations of varying densities that would stand out. But one of the reasons those lines showing the majority of calving were drawn is, and something I should point out, is these concentrations are snapshots. They're basically 1 or 2 day looks at the distribution of those animals during that 2 week calving period. In many of these years, the animals have continued to flow westward, for instance, after some of these concentrations were seen, and move other areas. So again, it's not like they're fixed in time and space, just as the red area there on the map is not the key point that the animals go to, but it is a regular use area.
Thank you.
Are we supposed to use this?
Yes, please.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. So when I heard you say calving is a dynamic thing, my message that I'm getting is that it's very difficult to quantify this dynamic thing of calving. And that means that areas, concentration, as well as place in time, predictability of where it will happen, is really quite unpredictable. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's we can, to some extent, and hopefully with a little more work, can perhaps predict to some degree based on things like snow condition, depths, densities, and so on. But it is very difficult to predict, and we probably will never be able to really predict it that well.
Well, if I can just follow on that point, you're just saying that you may have the ability to say that if the snow is so many feet deep, the caribou won't go there.
Or
you talk about snow condition or if the storm is blowing so many miles an hour, they may not want to walk through it. But you don't have any way of saying how deep the snow is going to be or what the weather is going to be.
No, right. And so this is really what you want to think about is, again, you have this general calving grounds, and I mentioned that it's traditional, but it's a dynamic traditionalism is about the best way to put it. The tradition is the area, the broad area that they go to. The dynamic part of it is what happens each year. Animals may all go to one spot. They may split up into many groups. And it's always changing and varying.
But the factors here we're dealing with is basically, as far as you can figure out, is weather. I mean, is there a predator issue here, too?
It's primarily, as far as the different distributions on the calving ground, primarily things like the proximity of the animals to begin with to the general calving ground, where they've wintered, conditions that are found, both physical, like snow depth and cover, on the spring migration routes, storms that hit that route, and similarly, the snow conditions and storms that may hit them as they're coming on to that calving ground. So for instance, as I mentioned, as a good example, there's now been a couple of years where the animals have calved primarily in the Yukon, where storms have hit them near the border, and they've basically gone ahead and paused in Canada. There have been other years, of course, when that hasn't happened, they've penetrated far west into Alaska. And there are years when they've gone part of that way and run into snow conditions that have basically stopped them from going further.
Okay, now you mentioned this year, there, Mr. Chairman, that they're wintering in the Alaska side, mm-hmm. near the Brooks Range. What would be your best prediction of where they're going to calve this spring?
Well, they're going to go to that general calving grounds.
But would they go all the way east into Canada?
Well, generally what happens, yes, they may. The reason being is that not too many of these animals go directly north when they're wintering in the Arctic Village area through the Brooks Range. What they do is they follow what we call the Chandelier route, which is along the south side of the Brooks, which actually leads them north eastward to the border. And the Brooks Range, basically the rugged aspect of it, runs out there, and the animals get into the Firth drainage and sometimes penetrate quite a ways into Canada before they loop back into Alaska onto the slope.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Springer?
Yeah, Dave. In your testimony, it showed me more than I previously realized the significance of the Canadian portion of the range. I'm also glad you gave the explanation on that somewhat misleading chart showing density of where it looks like density, mm-hmm. but it really isn't. It's a compilation of statistically time-related data for the same area, mm-hmm. and it suggests density, but it's actually only activity correlation. Okay. Two questions. One of them is in regards to calving and where that specific herd is when calving mechanisms take place. Have through that period of time, did the cows look like they were in the same shape for calving, or do you think the hardship or non-hardship due to several factors, human activity, hunting, predators, snow depths, climatic conditions, during the winter had an effect on it?
I mean, in terms of where the animals...
In terms of when they started to drop calves. In other words, did they look in the same physically prime condition for calving every year, or were there noticeable differences that okay. they had a tough winter and therefore the calving was influenced by it?
Right. Actually, it's very subjective, but the years that I've seen them, they have looked very similar. And one thing we can say that sort of gets at that a bit is that calving is pretty... has been one thing that's been pretty synchronous through the years. It's generally started within a few days each year of the same time and ended at about the same time, with the peaks occurring at about the same time. And we haven't seen any real outward signs of any differences like here.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I could add here that you commented on, that was the one other problem I forgot to mention that I do have with this, and that is that it emphasizes what we know about this particular part of the calving grounds, but it de-emphasizes all of the use in Canada and even further eastward in Alaska. And of course, all of this natural variation has been going on while the herd has been increasing quite well in size, and while it's using these fairly large different areas of Alaska and Canada.
Now that was my next question, Mr. Chairman, is the size and composition of the herd, has that been erratic or has there been a steady pattern?
Well, it appears to be relatively steady. This briefly, and there's some differences between the photosensuses. In the early 70s, a photosensus was made. There was quite a wide variation in the information, but it suggested in the order of about 100,000 animals. And from visually inspecting those animals as they aggregate and blocking them off by thousands, that looked realistic. In other words, we weren't off by 50,000. We may have been off by 10 or 20,000 sort of thing. 77. In techniques were improved. We got a pretty good photosensus, felt quite good about it, and it suggested in the order somewhere between 110 to 120 thousand. And the more recent photosensuses, now the raw scores on them have gotten upwards of 140,000. And then you can do the computations for additional animals, particularly adding the bulls that aren't there when you're photographing them, we're getting upwards of. The report says 180,000. It might not be quite that large. because that's an extrapolation from 3 years ago. But yeah, I think it's quite certain they're in the order of 150 to 160,000, and it seems to be roughly about 7. If you just look at those rough data points, it's been about 7% roughly a year, 7 to 10.
Would you venture to say anything about population modeling, what the peak capacity may be for that area?
That's a rough one, but one thing is that, there's some evidence that there's no reason why caribou couldn't reach capacities that are far larger than are found here, and habitat does not seem to be the limiting factor. They're well below their carrying capacity and probably will never reach it. You'll have that happen if you get into an insular situation like St. Matthew Island, reindeer put on it. No predators, lots of food. They increase to the carrying capacity and basically strip the land.
You don't see that as a problem here?
No.
One other question on population dynamics. Did you have a chance to radio call individuals and know over a more than one season period what a specific individual would do?
No, we didn't do any of that, and that's something that Alaska Department of Fish and Game, in cooperation with USFWS, has been doing these last few years. They've got a number of satellite callers, and they've used other radio callers on those animals, and they've gotten a couple years of information now, and they're just starting to get a good picture of that, what an individual animal does.
One last question. In regards to the Canadian side, do you feel the activities, the human activities on the Canadian side had any influence how the animals reacted in regards to westward movement in relation to time?
No, there was really, at least certainly when I was there, there was very little activity on the Canadian side, virtually none, really. In other words, you're saying, were there activities there that perhaps made them come into Alaska?
Apparently they had some oil-related activities during that period of time, because there were some wells drilled and some exploration activities were going on during that time, and at least partially during, I would suspect, during the time they were in their wintering, in their eastbound wintering grounds.
Okay, basically during the first number of years that I looked at the herd, there weren't any of those activities. Like if you're referring to the Beaufort area and Dome Petroleum and so on, that wasn't occurring yet and has since. But we've seen nothing that would indicate that there's been any change before or after that in terms of animals, how they're moving on the calving ground.
Thank you.
We're running a little behind schedule, but I think we're still going to have time to hear from everybody. Did other members have questions for Mr. Davidson? Did you have a question? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
We've got a couple people on teleconference. We'll try to get through and still try to wrap up everything we had intended to get to today. I'd ask those people in Anchorage, are three people. Mr. Brownfield, would you care to go first? I understand Mr. Brownfield represents the Alaska Coalition for American Energy Security. Did you have some comments, sir?
Yes, I do. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the House Resources Committee, my name is Boyd Brownfield. I'm appearing before you as the chairman of the Alaska Coalition for American Energy Security, as well as the president of the Resource Development Council. Our coalition is affiliated with the National Coalition for American Energy Security in Washington, D.C. Our membership includes numerous Alaskan organizations and individuals who have the single purpose goal to open the coastal plain of Anwar to responsible oil and gas development under reasonable environmental stipulations. As you are aware, the so-called core calving area, which we've already been discussing at length, and the porcupine caribou herd seem to become a very central issue in the environmental issues of Anwar. Now, there is an operating history of more than 15 years on the slope without significant environmental impact. What better record exists in the entire United States that a record that suggests that the coexistence is clearly not only possible, but it's been proven without degradation to either oil and gas development or the environment. Now, many concerns have been expressed by those opposing the opening of the coastal plain, but factual information which they present seems to be very minimal and general in nature. While the overall area in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is quite large, that portion proposed for exploration and development represents only 8% of the entire area. The actual surface impact to the resources of the refuge in this small area would certainly be minimal. Most analysis and discussions of environmental impacts and effects on wildlife resulting from exploration and production do not adequately reflect the experience of exploration and ongoing production in areas of the coastal plain adjacent to Anwar. This causes unwarranted opposition to the proposal of full leasing in the coastal plain. The worst case speculation of potential impacts on the porcupine caribou herd ignores much of that what industry and the regulatory agencies have learned to date about the interaction between Arctic oil development and caribou. A realistic approach would be to look at the impacts that are most likely to occur based on North Slope experience. Such an approach would yield realistic conclusions of negligible impacts to caribou population. This is especially true when coupled with the subjective nature of gathering the information as mentioned by the gentleman in Fairbanks just a second ago. The overemphasis on the importance of the so-called core calving area also leads many to dismiss past experience and studies which clearly show that caribou populations thrive in the midst of oil field activity on the North Slope. Historical data on the porcupine herd presented in a recent 1002 report by the Department of Interior clearly shows that the coastal plain from Babbage River to Canada across the 1002 area to the Canning River has been successfully used for calving, for caribou calving. The porcupine herd has, in fact, been observed in some recent years not even to use the so-called core calving area at all, and sometimes not even in Alaska. The herd has been observed to calf entirely outside the 1002 area. Thus, rather than a specific core area, calving habitat is a continuum across the Arctic coast from the Canning River to the Babbage River in Canada. Now, recognizing that the wide year-to-year variation in calving distributions and the enormous area in which the caribou choose to calf each year, it becomes increasingly clear that activities such as oil exploration and production, which use only a small portion of the abundant habitat, will not affect the calving success of caribou in Anwar. As we speak today, the caribou continue to use that area in and around the Kaparik River oil field for calving, and that herd continues to increase at rates similar to other North Slope herds, which is about 13 to 18% per year. The porcupine herd increases similarly, and there's no reason to expect that that would not continue to occur regardless of whether oil exploration exists or it doesn't exist. My concluding point, I believe, is that the importance the core calving area plays relative to the potential impacts from petroleum development should be minimized considerably, and it should be reevaluated. I would remind the committee that the industry presently operates under a very rigid permit system. Both state and federal agencies have the power to shut down any operation if permit conditions are not being met. Thus, if the coastal plain is open to exploration, development, and production, the government will continue to police the activities and must agree that all operations are environmentally safe. I'd like to make one last point, and if you recall last Tuesday, Mr. Bob Handler reported that certain spillages occurred on the North Slope at Prudhoe Bay, and he went on to say that there was about 23,000 spills, and beyond that gave what I would call more gee whiz figures to you. Let's bring more truth to those figures that Mr. Adler gave to you, and I get this according to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation sources. There were indeed about 23,000 spills. They were not all in Prudhoe Bay. Those spills included spills throughout the entire state of Alaska and not Prudhoe Bay. And it's interesting to note that a spill is classified as one quart or more droppage, which seems to be quite a small amount when you add that into 23,000 spills. Mr. Chairman, I thank you very much for your opportunity to speak to you and to speak to your committee. This is the conclusion of my statement. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Brownfield. We appreciate your remarks and your patience. I do want to get to the other people in Anchorage that want to testify there. So are Al Mackey and Tom Cook still there and still wish to testify?
Yes, good morning. My name is Dr. Alan Mackey. I'm the senior environmental advisor for Exxon Company USA here in Anchorage. I'm also chairman of the Caribou Task Group and the Biological Resources Subcommittee of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, AOGA, and I'm speaking this morning on behalf of AOGA. Today, I'd like to discuss with you AOGA's major comments on the biological and environmental issues contained in the Department of Interior's draft 1002 report. We believe that many of the impacts postulated in the 1002 report, particularly with respect to caribou habitat and caribou calving, are overstated, and I would like to offer our perspective for your information. I would like to point out that our views are also supported by the 1002 report reviews of three independent caribou experts contacted by AOGA: Dr. Tom Bergrud, University of Victoria, British Columbia; Mr. Ron Jakimchuk, Renewable Resources, Sydney, British Columbia; and Mr. Jim Curatolo of Alaska Biological Resources in Fairbanks. I would also like to discuss our concerns with the habitat-based approach to impact assessment proposed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. As you will see, we believe a population-based approach is more biologically sound, and we firmly believe that there are adequate data available to support full leasing of the coastal plain as provided for in Alternative A of the 1002 report, with confidence that biological resources will indeed be protected. The first issue having to do with caribou habitat. Numerous sections of the 1002 report discuss research on the behavior and movements of caribou in and around oil field development. The main problem with these discussions and the conclusions drawn is that they focus on habitat and do not consider the fact that habitat is not limiting caribou population growth for any Alaska herds, including the porcupine caribou herd. Therefore, conclusions regarding displacement of maternal cows or bulls carry little, if any, significance for the continued growth and survival of the herd. Since habitat is not limiting, loss of access to small portions of available habitat due to oil field development is not biologically significant. In the management of wildlife populations, the concept of habitat carrying capacity is the key to defining management goals for a herd. It's an established fact that neither the Central Arctic herd, which calves around the Prudhoe Bay Parrot Complex, nor the porcupine herd approach the carrying capacity of their ranges. Indeed, former Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Skoog stated in his 1968 thesis that, and I quote, "It seems likely that the Alaskan caribou population has remained far below range carrying capacity and that the total habitat has never been fully occupied. In reality, caribou populations seem to have maintained densities much lower than the maximum dictated by food alone, and hence the reduction in total range becomes less meaningful," unquote. We agree with Skoog's conclusion that habitat is not currently limiting the growth of the porcupine caribou herd and believe it supports our position. The small loss of habitat represented by likely development in the 1002 area will not impact growth or productivity of the caribou herd. Regarding caribou calving habitat, the core calving area concept has received much discussion in the 1002 report and elsewhere. Such an area has been assumed by the 1002 report authors to be critical to porcupine herd demographics, and therefore any displacement from this area would necessarily impact productivity. In fact, historical data for calving distribution did not support fidelity to a core calving area. These data clearly show that calving has occurred on the coastal plain, the Babbage River in Canada, which is 120 miles to the east of the 1002 area, to the canning area, which is the western boundary of the 1002 area. Thus, calving habitat is more correctly referred to as a continuum across the coastal plain rather than a specific core area. I'd like to leave you with that concept of a continuum. That's a very important point that we're trying to make here. The 1002 report in Chapter Fresno earlier this morning. Thus, it's important to understand that the porcupine herd has successfully calved over a very large area in the past. And while a concentrated calving area is obviously important to the herd, it is not critical nor fixed. Another point having to do with the National Environmental Policy Act, the EIS process, another major concern of the Town 2 report is the standard for judging environmental effects. Although not discussed, it is apparent that the standard used in the 1002 report is worst case. NEPA currently requires that a reasonably foreseeable standard be used, and we believe this would be more appropriate. Often, the NEPA-mandated EIS process is forced to predict environmental consequences of new developments, with little or no previous field experience to guide the predictions. Clearly, for the Anwar Coastal Plain, however, the test case has already been run at Prudhoe Bay. Collectively, the experience of the regulatory agencies and industry is captured in the 1002 report on page 2, which states, and I quote, "The evidence generated during the 18 years of exploration and development at Prudhoe Bay indicates that minimal impact on wildlife resources. Hence, it is reasonable to assume that development can proceed on the coastal plain and generate similar minimal effects," unquote. Jointly, the industry and regulatory agencies have expended literally millions of dollars and hundreds of man years' effort to characterize the interaction of fish and wildlife with the oil field development in and around the Prudhoe Bay area. This effort has led to an excellent understanding of the impacts of oil field development and to the development of tried and proven mitigation techniques to ensure the compatibility of wildlife and oil field interests. In other words, there are sufficient data available to predict the reasonably foreseeable outcome at Anwar. We therefore support the statement, also on page 2 of the 1002 report, that, quote, "Most adverse effects would be minimized or eliminated through carefully applied mitigation, using the lessons learned and technology acquired from development at Prudhoe Bay and from construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, TAPS," unquote. Thus, we do not feel that the proposed 10-year moratorium to develop additional biological data on calving frequency and distribution is either necessary or justified in light of the preponderance of available information. Indeed, we'd like to point out that all of the environmental activists' unwarranted predictions of 15 years ago, prior to the construction of TAPS, have subsequently been proven false. The demise of major caribou herds, alterations in water quality, and major losses of habitat simply have not occurred. Conversely, the development of Prudhoe Bay and TAPS have allowed Alaskans to enjoy a period of economic prosperity in harmony with a high-quality environment and thriving wildlife populations. Thank you for the opportunity to present these views.
Thank you, Dr. Mackey. And other questions? Mr. Sun?
Well, I just wanted to clarify something. If I understand your argument, is that in this calving area, the caribou have been displaced in the past by storm and by snow and have had adequate habitat to calve. And you're saying your argument is that you don't think the development will displace them from their calving area, but if they are displaced from the calving area because of development, that there is adequate habitat which has been utilized in the past to continue the growth of the herd. Is that a good encapsulation of your comment?
Yes, that's accurate. Basically, I'm referring to much of the data that you saw in greater detail earlier this morning from Dave Rosenow, which clearly indicates.
I know we're on caribou, but could your group also give us something of what you're going to do with the solid waste disposal up there?
Why don't we see if we can try to get that at a later point?
I just want it later. I don't care now.
Are there other questions? All right. Mr. Cook, are you still with us?
He's not here, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to, at this time, move into the second part of what we had planned for this morning, and that has to do with one of the other consensus points that's mentioned in the resolution that's before the committee, and that has to do with employing the workforces of the state. I'd ask Mano Fry if you'd like to come join us, and I'd also ask Ned Farquhar, the committee assistant, to give us a brief preface on some of the information that he's been able to track down to begin with. You can just sit right here if you want.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to let Ned
sure.
make some preparations.
Very briefly on the topic of local hire, as it could be employed in Anwar, Senator Murkowski in the last budget bill last year was able to get language in that required local hire for construction of defense facilities in Fairbanks. We had been looking at that as a model for the Anwar leasing. In fact, we find from Senator Murkowski's staff that there are constitutional constraints that prevent us from using that same sort of approach or language. Instead, Senator Murkowski's staff suggests that we might want to look at the way that OCS leasing has been done in the past and the way that the Secretary of Interior has instructed in the lease that, in the lease form, that the lessee will try to consider local needs, including employment, and encourage local hire. We're trying to track down that language right now from Senator Murkowski's office and might be able to suggest exact language that we can include in the resolution, HJR 9. And I will supply that to the committee as soon as we get it from Senator Murkowski's office.
Thank you, Ned. Any questions for the staff? Welcome to Juneau, Mr. Fry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, my name is Mano Fry, and I'm the executive president of the Alaska AFL-CIO. I think many of you know that the position that the AFL-CIO and the Teamsters Union have taken jointly regarding Anwar development is that we support, as we have traditionally always supported, environmentally sound development. With the case of Anwar, the only way that we will support opening up the coastal plain for development is if there is strong local hire contractual arrangements with the developers and also an established prevailing wage so that those people who work in the area will be paid an amount that will allow them to live in the state of Alaska. I'd like to talk about those two items and certainly applaud your efforts as far as making sure that the resolution contains Alaska hire language, and we feel very strongly that there are ways to reach that. I also know that there are people here from the Fairbanks area that represent many of the people that are being impacted the most dramatically with what's gone on in the Prudhoe Bay, North Slope area. And I hope that they'll have an opportunity to also testify in front of your committee. It was very interesting and certainly very educational listening to the testimony and seeing the whole picture of the Anwar area develop. I'm certainly very happy that the caribou are going to be well taken care of. I'm sure that they're going to be real pleased too. And we've seen this chart and map referred to many times. Well, I'd like to refer to a map that's a little larger in scope, and if you'd each turn to the wall there and take a look, it's the state of Alaska. And it's the people of Alaska. And you cannot, it's nice to take care of the caribou, but you cannot overlook the most important environmental resource that you have to deal with. That's the people of Alaska. And that's who's being impacted right now in the Prudhoe Bay area, and it's who is going to be impacted if Anwar is allowed to be developed and opened up for exploration without strict guidelines and safeguards. The oil industry is infamous for taking credit for doing things safely, but they never would have if they hadn't have been forced into it. Mr. Brownfield testified earlier that they have a 15-year record in Prudhoe Bay of safe development. That's absolutely true, and it's quite admirable. But those of you who were here when Prudhoe Bay and the TAPS line was allowed to be built, remember, they didn't do it voluntarily. They didn't come forward and say, we want to make sure there are no spills. They were forced into it. There was a 5-year lawsuit that stopped the pipeline construction until those environmental issues were worked out. There are many reasons that people point to for increasing the cost of the pipeline construction. The most important factor was that they had to build it environmentally safe. They had to assure that, while the pipeline was pumping oil, that from Prudhoe Bay to the Valdez terminal, that it was all the environmental potential hazards were resolved before any construction took place. And that's what we are proposing for ANWR. Only our experience has shown that we need to go a couple steps more. There has to be some way to make sure Alaskans are allowed to work on those jobs. What's going on right now in Prudhoe Bay is the subcontractors, and you'll see just recently there were some statistics released from the Department of Labor showing Alaska Hire in different areas. And I am only singling out the oil industry this morning because that's what we're talking about. There are other industries that certainly have worse records, and those need to be addressed also. But the record for the subcontractors hiring Alaskans is terrible. And don't be fooled by those that try to wrap up direct hire of ARCO and Standard Alaska Production, because their direct hire records are excellent. But it's the subcontractors. It's Brown and Root and Vico. Terrible. The thing that happens is that they're allowed to bid and work those jobs based on whoever can pay the lowest wage. There has to be an established prevailing wage so that there will be a floor in wages so that people know when they go up there that they'll be able to live and raise families in this state. Listening to Ron Zobel yesterday at the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, it's one of the three methods he suggested that's constitutional. And people may not agree with Ron Zobel, but he's got the best track record so far as revealing what isn't possible with Alaska Hire, and I hope that people would listen to him. He said one of the things that can be done is the establishment of a prevailing wage, and we encourage that. The downward spiral has resulted in each of you with constituents that are right now losing homes, the breakup of the families, the alcohol and the other problems, the other social problems that are now occurring in escalating proportions in this state. And each of you can do something about stopping. Talking about the caribou is fine and wonderful, but there's a greater resource that I hope each of you will take seriously and try to do something about making sure that ANWR and all other future developments, that the human resource that live in Alaska will be taken care of properly. Mr. Chairman, I have several other things, and I don't want to take up any more time, but if I...
We've got a lot of time, so we're here at least until 10 o'clock.
Okay. One of the things that, when our position was first revealed, we had a press conference in Fairbanks, and we spoke about our position regarding ANWR development. A couple days later, the Anchorage Times ran an editorial that was titled Short-Sighted Spite. And I'd just like to say that if the development of ANWR is rushed in as the oil industry and their supporters would have us believe, that's short-sighted spite. As long as the oil's in the ground, and as long as a plan is being developed to rationally develop that area, and make sure you include not just the caribou, but the whole state of Alaska and the people that live here. It's money in the bank, and it's drawing interest right now. If you rush in as the oil industry would have you do, it'd be a shame for the people of Alaska, the few that are going to be left, because none of them will be working in that area. And what will happen is that the subcontractors who will be given not mandatory but voluntary percentages to try to achieve of Alaskan Hire, and that's what the oil industry does now. It's all voluntary. Voluntary is wonderful, but it doesn't work, because what happens is they pay such a low wage, nobody in Alaska will go to work up there. But people that are out of work in Louisiana and Oklahoma, they think $8 and $9 an hour is great. And they're provided travel, and they're provided room and board, and they're provided a trip home. So they think it's great, but the people of Alaska don't and are not given the opportunity. And I would just try to remind you again that it's not short-sighted spite to take care of it properly before the development takes place. We all seem to live through the five-year period when Alyeska wasn't allowed to build the pipeline. And when it started, all the things were in place, all the safeguards were in place prior to a single shovel full being turned over. That's what needs to happen with ANWR. And I just want to mention one thing that can happen as far as good faith. And I think it goes a long way in showing that we've said many times that we're not throwing stones, and we're not, because we are not having been at fault as far as Alaskan Hire. Many of the unions in Alaska in the past have sometimes had a rather poor Alaskan Hire record, but we have continually striven and worked toward getting better. I want to give you just one example of what can happen, and it's legal. It's already been tested by the National Labor Relations Board. The laborers in Fairbanks have negotiated several agreements where they will assure that 100% of the people that are dispatched under those agreements will be Alaskans. They've developed a criteria where they have a committee review, and it's not a 30-day. Many of the unions have 6-month and 12-month residency requirements. What the laborers in Fairbanks have done is typical of many of the other local unions in the state of Alaska, the language that we're now developing. And I would say that it is possible and it is legal, and I would hope that you would not rush into any quick decision, that you would exhaust every constitutional means to make sure that ANWR is developed properly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be happy to answer any questions anybody might have.
I'll just say thanks for coming. It's good to see you. As you know, we're in the process of attempting to craft a statement about the legislature's feeling about the Coastal Plain and its development, and that there are a lot of things that I'd like to do and other committee members would like to do, but unfortunately a lot of these rules are going to be made by someone else, and again, we're going to make what amounts to an advisory statement, we hope, to United States Congress and the Department of Interior. I think most of us recognize that employment of people that live here in Alaska is one of the most important benefits that we could expect from the development up there. And as far as a public policy statement, I think that's something very legitimate to be concerned about. It seems like one of the complaints or one of the other political footballs that gets kicked around is some people suggest that you're not really that concerned about Alaska Hire, you're more concerned about, some people are more concerned about Union Hire. And they don't necessarily, not everybody agrees on that statement. I just wonder, when somebody suggests that, what sort of response you make, other than what you may have already addressed that.
That's an excellent question, and in fact, in the last elections in November, there was quite an issue in several races over some of the legislation that was proposed last session, and I'm sure you're well aware of some of that, Representative Cotton, because you were involved. What was said during this last election, some of the campaigns, is that the efforts of the union's last session were to mandate Union Hire with some of the proposed legislation. And as you know, and those that were here last session know, nothing could absolutely be further from the truth. And regarding our position on ANWR, right now there's a law in place that when the state or municipal entities contract out capital construction work, there is a law in place that establishes a prevailing wage, and all the contractors have to pay that wage. It doesn't say union or non-union. but it establishes a prevailing wage. And we take our chances. Sometimes jobs go to union contractors, sometimes they go non-union. But at least our contractors have a fair chance at bidding that work, and the people in the state get a fair chance at working those jobs because it's a fair prevailing wage. And it's not, the jobs don't go to whoever can pay the lowest wage. It establishes a floor and it pays a fair wage. And it encourages contractors to hire locally, which was the whole original intent of the Davis-Bacon Law, for those that may understand the history of it. That's what we want to see on ANWR. There isn't any reason. It's federal land. There isn't any reason on state land that it shouldn't have been put into effect in law many years ago. But we take our chances every day when the state and municipalities put their work out to bid, and we'll take our chances in ANWR as long as it's fair. And that's all that we ask, is that we get a fair chance for the people that live here to go to work.
Thank you, man. I just want to reflect the presence of Representative Navarre and Pierce, and I think Mr. Davidson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Troy, I have a union background myself, and I understand some of the mechanics that goes into trying to maintain a standard of living for working people that is respectable. But I do have some questions as regards your comments, and they should be in no way taken as an anti-working type of statement or an anti-working person type of statement. First, a comment simply about prevailing wage. I think it's imperative that working people also understand that there is the element of the cost of doing business. And I think we have to learn not only as working people, but as businesses, to work smarter and not necessarily harder, given the technological tools that we have to deal with today. My questions concern the corporations who are, in fact, hiring non-Alaskans. And frequently we hear the argument that, well, there aren't enough trained people to do some of these jobs. So my first question is, what has your union or unions done to, in fact, counter the matter of training as regards to companies such as you mentioned to ensure that they have a qualified workforce? And secondly, you address the map of the state of Alaska and the people who live there. I have a concern that you mentioned, and this ties in also with local hire, and involves the porcupine herd and those who are dependent upon that for their livelihood, for their way of life. It seems that you're willing to trade, quite frankly, urban workforce economic security for those who live upon the resources of the land. And I was just wondered if you could touch upon that and expand on your position.
I'll answer the first one, but I have a question about your second question, Representative Davidson. That's that how out of my testimony did you ever reach that conclusion? But let me answer your first question first. The unions in Alaska have established and have a record of, you can go back more than 40 years, the apprenticeship and training programs that we have been involved with. And it includes, in fact, this may be partly to answer your second question, includes training programs set up in rural areas, and as well as the urban areas. But we have worked very closely, in fact, with some of the Native communities and Native groups to make sure that they have always been an integral part of the training and apprenticeship programs. And it's reached every corner of the state. The training, the apprenticeship centers are usually established as far as a core of buildings, but virtually every single one of them is mobile and has had classes in different areas using the community college system, for instance, or some of the skill centers. Use those as some of the physical centers for training in other areas besides just the main residential areas of the state.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I guess maybe what I should do is be more specific. I don't know that much about oil field work. I have been aroused about, but the fact is, we get this idea that
there are special kinds of training for oil company activities. Does the union address that kind of training program?
I appreciate the fact that you're trying to zero in on it a little bit. There isn't a single skill that they require, that the oil industry requires, that someone in Alaska either doesn't possess or has the ability right now, or is at least trainable and would be able to be trained in a very short period of time. The argument about not being able to get enough people to fill certain skill positions, that's truly one of the big lies. It's just not true. There are right now plenty of people to fill any positions that that would have to be filled. Now there have been periods of time in the state during the development when, even with maxing out all the training programs that were available, like during the construction of the pipeline, I don't think there's any doubt in anybody's mind that during that period of time that it was necessary, we needed help from others other than just Alaskans. But that certainly isn't the case now.
I believe you said you had a question for me on the other one.
Oh, I just wasn't exactly sure what, if you could be a little more specific with your second question.
If I may, Mr. Chairman. Local hire becomes local hire when you're in a village situation.
Yes.
And I would submit to you that the unions are not doing all in their power to, in fact, encourage the participation of local village hire within the context of union local hire. And so I would submit to you that I think that the record could be improved upon. And as regards the people of the state of Alaska, the people who depend upon the porcupine herd for their sustenance and subsistence are also part of our great state. And if we are to displace, perhaps, and I know this is, as we heard testimony today, some of that livelihood or ability to survive, what do we replace it? What opportunities do we give them?
Sure. And I certainly think that there's been an interest shown in with the people that live in that area and depend on that area right now for their survival. They have expressed an interest for developing ANWR. And I will commit to you and anybody else that's involved down here in the legislative process that we'll certainly do whatever's appropriate and necessary and include. We have already spoken to some of the people that are involved in training in some of the skill centers and some of the rural areas already regarding ANWR development. We'll do whatever is necessary to make sure that those people are given priority, even as far as any of the work and jobs. We have no problem with that. Never have had, and I think a best way to, as an example, is your constituents in the Kodiak area. The unions, for instance, have always given preferential hire to those qualified people that live in Kodiak for any jobs there, mm-hmm. And I think that we have an excellent track record. But if there are areas where we're lacking, you just load us right up. We'll comply with anything that we're not doing. We'll certainly be the first to lead the way. We're not afraid to help this state as far as Alaskan hire or any of the other things that we're talking about.
Thank you. I think we're on the right track.
Any other questions for Mr. Fry? Well, we've enjoyed your company. There are a couple of the people I know, Barry Heights here and Joe Thomas, and I'm not sure if they were wishing to testify. They signed up to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mano, very much.
Thank you, Mano.
Joe or Barry, if you're interested, please come
Jim
forward.
Carroll, I think I'm good.
Tim Carroll, is that it?
Yeah.
Jim.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Barry Haidt. I'm president of the Fairbanks Central Labor Council, AFL-CIO. State President Fry has already reiterated our position on ANWR, which we took in early December, and that position has not changed. I would like to focus in on a couple items, and that is that labor has taken a broader view of this development of ANWR. I am concerned about the headlong rush into some quarters to develop it at any cost. I sense a feeling that just get Anwar opened, we'll all be better by osmosis, and I say no, we won't. We haven't necessarily been all better to all degrees in Prudhoe Bay. Our stewardship of Prudhoe Bay, right as we speak, is failing in many areas. The environmental concerns could have been better. It comes to mind a massive spill of refined petroleum product into what was once pristine Galbraith Lake. I don't think that's a good record. The Alaskan hire is almost non-existent up there. And finally, the state share of revenues from Prudhoe Bay is now within many millions of dollars, not what it should have been or should be currently. To turn around and repeat those same mistakes with Anwar would not do credit to this legislature, to organized labor, or the population of the state of Alaska. And I think that we should look at the bigger picture, and I think that all of us as Alaskans should question the development of Anwar if any major element of benefit to the state is absent, whether it's proper revenue for the state, Alaskan hire, prevailing wage, or consideration for the environment. I'm very concerned about that, and while we sit in hearings such as this and we see films and hear other testimony regarding the environment and concern for the welfare of the state and the people in it, I can only compare that to a recent article in an Anchorage newspaper quoting ARCO President Harold Hines, who was telling West Coast businessmen that the coastal plain there was a flat, crummy place and that the only reason anyone would go there was for oil. I think that speaks of a deep sentiment and a highly placed official in the oil companies. I would personally infer that that negative sentiment would probably apply to more than just that environment. And finally, I would say, while it's not the official policy of the AFL-CIO, as president of the Central Labor Council in dealing with those voters and union members I represent, and hearing people talk on the street, they get a sense of foreboding of where we're really going with Anwar. And some of them are beginning to say, if we're going to see a repeat of Prudhoe Bay, maybe we should leave it in the ground. Thank you.
Mr. Sund had a question for you.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I thank you. I really appreciate you bringing up the third aspect of this. I didn't know if this hearing today was to bring that out, but and that's the benefit to the state treasury. And I have a comment, and I've made it to Mr. Hines several times, but I'm from Ketchikan. And my basic analysis is that not one dime of oil money ever arrived in Southeast Alaska except through the state treasury. So if you want my perspective, the development at all costs, I don't agree with that. And I believe that the environmental and labor issues need to be considered. But if the development of Anwar results in $0 to the state of Alaska, that doesn't get anybody in Southeast Alaska very excited. So I just want to comment, appreciate you bringing the third factor to the table. It's one I've made before and I'll make again, but I didn't know if it was relevant today, but thank you.
You're very right, Representative Sund. You see, we have union members and voters in Southeastern, and they do rely on capital projects and other amenities provided by government. It's not lost on us that the state constitution gives the province of these minerals and wealth under the ground to the state. And whether you agree with it or not, that's the way it is, and so labor deals with it from that posture.
Thank you, Barry. Welcome, Senator Petrillo.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Mr. Carroll?
Very good. Mr. Chairman, committee. My name is Jim Carroll. I'm the president of the Fairbanks Building Construction Trades. Thank you for letting me testify today. As you know, the state of Alaska is in an economic decline due to many factors, oil being the main problem. If the decline keeps up, the state stands to lose its greatest resource, which is its people. Due to the lack of work and depressed wages being brought about by the economic time, the first to leave will be the young workers, which the state needs to be viable in the future. If some avenue is not used to give people an incentive to remain here, we are defeating our own purposes. I believe we need regulations on Anwar and any and all projects affecting the state of Alaska to make sure we, the people of Alaska, can afford to live in this state and support its economy. On the whole, we have the most highly trained and diversified population of any place in the world. I believe steps must be taken to make sure they remain in the state. You as legislators have in your power to give us regulations that will benefit Alaska and make us viable worldwide. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. How are things in Fairbanks these days?
Fine.
We can go to work. Are there other questions? Thank you very much, sir. Did you wish to testify, Joe?
Yes, I just had one brief, or
please come forward.
Brief comments.
Good morning. Is this on, or?
Yes, sir. Please identify yourself for the record.
Joe Thomas, I'm the Business Manager, Secretary, Treasurer of Labor's Local 942 in Fairbanks. And I, too, would like to talk about another subject that was mentioned briefly, but actually we're here today to talk about resident hires as it relates to ANWR. And I would like to just make a brief comment on that subject. Thank you for the opportunity for me to be here and speak to you today. I'll avoid the statistics and the data that you've all gone over for several years now regarding resident hire in the state of Alaska. We've heard for a long time the great numbers of people that are not residents working on the North Slope of Alaska and a variety of the other industries throughout the state. This seems to have been the situation in Alaska as long as I can remember, and sooner or later it needs to be rectified. And I think that now is possibly the best time that, as we study the problem, that now is a good time to address it. And that's what I'm here today to encourage you to do. Appropriate action is required and needs to be done, and I think this legislative session is the time to do it, because we are getting to a critical time in our development of our industries and the procedure that we develop them. We're not showing very good procedures, or very standard procedures anyhow. Our most important resource, which is our people, is not being developed at all. And I am glad to see that someone has looked into the situation, or is looking into the situation, that Senator Murkowski, who also saw a problem and addressed it in defense legislation for projects in the state of Alaska. And I think that if it can be done on the federal level, which is where we seem to run into problems normally, that it can certainly be done in the state. Therefore, as I said earlier, I'll avoid the statistics and any of the evidence. I think it's all in. I think that there really isn't much dispute of what's being done. Some people just don't want to talk about it much and just kind of brush it aside and say, well, you know, we won't talk about the resident hire situation, shuffle it off. Emphasis is not being placed on resident hire, and I think, as I said before, it's one of the most important things that we can do. It's our most important resource. There was some mention of training in the state of Alaska. We had 10,000 people working in the oil industry at one time on the Alyeska pipeline, and most of that work done in connection with the building of camps, pads, the connection of pipe, the insulating of pipe, the thermal pilings that are put in, all that is repeated over and over in places like Prudhoe Bay. One representative said he's not particularly familiar with the oil industry, but it's a very repetitive situation. There are always differences in one area or another, but it's quite similar. We do have a lot of people trained. A lot of people are leaving now because they can't find jobs, but there are people trained in all the unions and all the communities that could work up there. It's not that difficult of a work as far as the as what's required of the individual worker. I think that it's incumbent upon you folks, as you sit here today, to make sure that any resolution that leaves the state of Alaska headed for Washington, D.C., indicating our concerns or what we think needs to be addressed, should include resident hire. I think that's absolutely necessary. And I also believe that any legislation passed in the future regarding extraction of resources should include language that would appropriately address resident hire. Basically, that's why I'm here today, to encourage you to do those things, to make sure that resident hire appears in any either resolution that leaves the state of Alaska destined for Washington, D.C., or any legislation that you pass in the future regarding the extraction of any resources from the state of Alaska. And that's all I had to say today. Thank you for the opportunity, and if you have any questions, I'll certainly try to answer them.
Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, Joe, just one question in terms of a resolution leaving here with resident hire. Just a brief thought of what Mano was saying in terms of prevailing wage. I hadn't thought about it very much. Is there a way of putting in a prevailing wage provision in here?
Well, I think there probably is. Anything's possible, as they say. I think that one of the problems you might arrive at in is trying to determine what is a prevailing wage. And of course, the wages at Prudhoe Bay have been depressed severely. We're finding that people are working at Prudhoe Bay cheaper than they're probably working in similar industries anyplace else, not only in the state, but anyplace else in the nation. You can take the wages at Prudhoe Bay and go down to West Texas or East Texas and Louisiana and find that they're probably paying as much, if not more, in those areas. And whether you want to believe the newspapers or not, I read the other day that it costs 40% more to live in the state of Alaska. So I think that it would be difficult to determine if you did it. I'm not sure how you'd go about it.
Mr. Navarre?
My understanding that a lot of those working up there are from West and East Texas.
That's very true. So it seems normal to them. That's right. That's right. That's exactly right.
Mr. Davidson?
That's fine. I have my answer. Thank you.
Oh. Well, thank you very much again. Are there others that haven't had a chance to testify? Yes, sir.
My bell's calling. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, sir.
Very interesting.
Welcome to the time.
My name is David Guttenberg, and I don't represent the FLCIO or the Chamber of Commerce or the American Greeting Card Company. Maybe that's how come I'm last. I'm a construction worker, and I make my living with my back. I do for a living what you raise your children to be better than. I'm not an executive who gets a report on what to tell you, and it comes in here and pleads their case. I worked 13 years at Umiak, Prudhoe Bay, Parak, Milne Point, and offshore Arctic Coast. And that includes 4 weeks out of the last 21 months working for VECO. And I can tell you that Prudhoe Bay is not Alaskan. It's not represented by Alaskan hire. And I can give you the names of people who've worked up there, who are offered Alaskan addresses to use in case they needed them to prove their residency. And unlike oil industry data, this information is available to you. I'm here today talking to you as one of those who has most to gain by the development of ANWR, but from where I sit, I oppose it until such time as a strong resident hard language is written into the development agreement. Right now, only the resource developers stand to gain, and just the developers, the small business need to be able to buy their goods and services without the jobs and small businesses are the core of every community. Cannot survive and sustain or prosper. They get that out of my paycheck, and I'm not working on it. After more than a decade of building the largest oil fields in North America and its infrastructure, the Alaskan construction work has been displaced by cheap outside labor. Suddenly, it's a sea of round boys. There's this article out of the Empire last week. That's a survey from Fish and Wildlife, and more Texans endorsed the development of ANWR than Alaskans. And here we are unemployed. Our jobs are still going on, only we're not the ones doing them. And where are our next jobs coming from, and when does our unemployment run out? I'm 36, and I'm too old to join the National Guard. And now we're talking about ANWR. ANWR has a good chance of being a good percentage of what Prudhoe Bay is, and it adds up to years of employment for thousands. The competition isn't someone from Colorado. The competition of these oil executives and their jobs to maximize their company's returns on its investments. You have to decide if that top percentage of their profits is going to their shareholders all over the world, or does it stay here and get infused into our economy by me spending my paycheck in a small local business. The quality of life of thousands of Alaskans is on a decline right now, with homes being lost and families being displaced. Maybe when you get home, one of these families will have bought the lot next to yours and moved in a 40-year-old mobile home and their collection of priceless antique junkers that their screaming huskies live in. We're all going to be affected, but we can affect change. We got to start right now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. I appreciate your succinct remarks and the interspersion with a little bit of levity there. And I assure you, you didn't end up last for any other reason, and that's just where I finally got to. I sort of wasn't trying to discriminate against any of the working people here. I'm sure you know that. Are there others that haven't had a chance to say anything and would like to? We'll be adjourned here in a few minutes, but I just wanted to say that as far as the hearings on this resolution and this topic are concerned, I feel like we've covered the different subjects. Local hire, the Caribou, and whether or not to open, the land trades, the environmental issues that are associated with the area that we're discussing. One area that we haven't really had a hearing on, but our staff will prepare a memo for the committee members and others that are concerned, have to do with one of the other revenue issues, the so-called 90-10 split. And we've put together some information about some of the history on that, where it showed up in the statehood compact, what sort of agreements the United States and Alaska have in that regard, what sort of some of the precedents in relation to NPRA have been. So I would await and encourage direction from the committee if after you get that information, you feel that you'd like to have a hearing on that, we can do that. Also, if there are other issues that committee members feel that would require a public hearing, I know there have been some discussion about some local residents in the area may want to offer some testimony. If the committee members know of others that feel that they'd like to have a chance to discuss any issue in front of the committee, please let me know. Otherwise, Mr. Sunday, I see you're anxiously trying to get.
Well, I think the revenue to the state of Alaska is a big issue. At least it is with me, and I would appreciate maybe we have to get Ned's statements on where we're at on that. But I would like to have a hearing if we have someone out of the Attorney General's office or somebody who's been working on where we are on that compact, the history of it, why we have a 90-10 split, where we're going, and I think back in the beginning, I asked for a matrix of kind of showing. The split between private land, state land, that overriding royalty issue you brought up. So maybe we can wait till we get the document, but I would appreciate an opportunity to take some testimony on that issue.
Okay. Mr. Springer?
Yeah, one of my concerns is still that we have a meridian artificially separating Canada from Alaska. And here's that whole thing ties together with them geologically, environmentally, ethnographically. And we got the Canadian people here. Are they going to testify tomorrow, or are they going to be here for a social gathering from the Yukon government?
We've invited the representatives from the Yukon Legislative Assembly to come and join us tomorrow, and I understand that one of the topics they want to discuss with this committee is this very subject. So we would entertain and welcome any conversations and information they wish to share with us.
Yeah, I think that would be a good opportunity. I'm especially interested since they already went through a exploratory era in the adjacent area, and here they are screaming about the environmental concerns which we are supposedly not addressing, and I would be very keen trying to find out what they have found with their program.